So some of what I'm going to say will be redundant, but if that means low information temperature, perhaps that's what we want at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But I will actually just reiterate something Mark said about the importance of John Cayley. If it's the case that Vectors is the fulfillment of the vision of the merger of multimedia and scholarship, traditional paradigms of scholarship, I do very much see John Cayley as the fulfillment of a vision of a new media writing practice that would be both a coding practice and a literary practice. Okay, so I'm going to speak primarily about his project Translation, but I want to start just by reading a few lines of a HyperTalk experiment that he performed, and I will try to strip affect from my voice to do this, which probably shouldn't be hard. Okay, on right. On right, repeat twice, do global and characteristics, end repeat, repeat with programmers equals one to always, if touching, then put essential into invariance, else put the round of simplicity plus engineering slash synchronicity plus one into invariance, end if. In his programmable media and in his critical essays on code work, some of which Mark mentioned, John Cayley has endeavored to call our attention to the material differences between code addressed to a reader and code addressed to the machine. And he'll talk about the one as a pretend code practice and the other as a genuine code practice. The HyperTalk experiment with which I opened illustrates that difference through the form of a poem program that's operational within the realms of both natural and programming languages. It signifies and functions within both symbolic systems in that it's capable of altering either one. It's interpretable working code that is also human readable. Its address, then, is ambiguous. The code could alter the behavior of the system if it were included as one routine in a text generator with the acknowledgement that its execution might be inconsequential. And the code could also be interpreted by a human reader with the acknowledgement that the lines are less meaningful than they are elusive. Designed both for reading and for compilation, then, this text collapses and yet also situates the difference between program and poem. It prompts two different readings and two different interpretations. Now, Jutta Steidel, in an essay for the I Love You Virus exhibition, has claimed that the hermeneutics of source code do exist, and maybe that's somewhat in the same space as the line from Lost Glacier that Mark used when he spoke about code as akin to innovative poetry. Right? So Jutta Steidel's claim that the hermeneutics of source code do exist. If we were able to read code properly, in other words, which is to say with the proper literary sensibility, then we would be able to recognize what Steidel calls the true beauty of human language. Far from alone in expressing the general sentiment that program code is itself artistic material, rather than the functional process by which the real work of art is produced, Steidel would have rather less support for the notion that one could read code precisely as language, much less support for the notion that an unmediated encounter with code as the original primary text would be possible at all. While it's certainly the case that high-level programming languages such as HyperTalk are readable in a general sense, as you can see, and that linguistic knowledge is continually translated into putatively neutral programming structures, critics such as Andrew McKenzie and Kate Hales have pointed to the limits of signification as it's conventionally understood with regard to code. And here I'm interested in actually some chapters of My Mother as a Computer that haven't yet been discussed, the chapters in which she outlines the tripartite world universe, actually sort of progressivist speech writing code. And the book by Andrew McKenzie that I'm dealing with is a book called Cutting Code. So, for example, we might ask if the linear nature of signification still pertains in the context of a program that does not read from left to right, or that is linear not to the reader, but to the program as it executes. And therein we can locate the difference of the sign system of code, its executability, its operative transformation of a message from one symbolic form to another. Or to return to Cayley's experiment, and this is to stay within the parameters of his work, code and language alike may amuse, astonish, inform, and delight. Both may be written and read. Both are performative and may initiate changes in the world, but one can be executed by the computer and one cannot. And as a point of contrast, Florian Kramer has a long essay, monograph really, called Word Made Flesh, that charts the cultural history of code poetics, and what he's interested in are algorithmic texts that can be found in a medieval or a pre-modern moment as well. So Kramer and Cayley would be very much on opposite sides of the issue here. We can turn to Cayley's recent work in order to consider further the relations between code and text, algorithm and output, as they are articulated in the context of new media writing. As its title makes apparent, translation will be the paradigmatic concept through which to apprehend these relations. And I'll start running translation for you eventually, but this is just a screen capture, and it, of course, resembles Overboard that you've just seen. Like the Whitney Artport Code Doc show, with which translation has certain affinities, this project of Cayley's will also ask where we situate artistic, cultural, and institutional value with the code, that is, with technique or skill, with the execution, that is, with the mechanism or with the process, or with the output, that is, with the object. Specifically, I'll read Cayley's transliteral work as a way of addressing two elements of code, the discursive and the functional, its opacity on the one hand and its generative quality on the other. So I'm interested essentially in the extent to which the inaccessibility of code has not been thought of, or has not been, I suppose, thought of with the kind of critical attention that one would want to see. So the generative quality of code will allude to the computational hypothesis, a kind of totality of computation, to which there'll be a certain resistance and a certain playing upon in this paper. Transcode, then, invokes not only the translation of one media format into another, and not only the transfer of computer concepts into the cultural realm, as Lev has explained, but also code as metacode and code as the transcendental. On the surface, translation performs continually evolving translations, or symbolic translations, rather, among English, French, and German versions of excerpts taken from both Proust and Walter Benjamin's essay On Language as Such and the Language of Man. So, like Overboard, that takes the Bradford on Plymouth Plantation as its source text, so to speak. Here he's working with source text taken from Proust again and Benjamin. In its interior, translation is an algorithmically generated text, a kinetic language painting characterized by its operative performance. It is also literal art, the name Cayley gives to his art practice that explores morphological and symbolic connections among words and letters. And this practice has become more sophisticated from his earlier work, River Island, which here does the morphing with Chinese characters and here English characters. And what he points out, of course, is that there's actually no conceptual basis for the kind of morphing that happens here. It looks cool, as he says, but it's conceptually unsound. There's no rationale for explaining how that character morphs into English, right? As if it were English scrambled. And then, of course, there's Overboard as his other example. In all, the screen space may be organized by stanza and poetic line, but the letter is the primary unit of analysis. And then, as Mark explained, Cayley tends to pair letters that are proximate and or bear a morphological relation to each other. So I and J are paired, and B and P, and so forth. The grid cells, though, operate in a sequence transposition, much like what we saw in Overboard. Though translation implies a teleological structure in its ambient states of floating, sinking, and surfacing, translation does not definitively proceed from opacity to clarity or from clarity to opacity. Indeed, a complete realization of the text is markedly temporary. This is unlike Overboard, actually. The English language version of Benjamin, for example, or of Proust, can be summoned by keystroke to the surface as an integral unit only briefly before the proper letters begin to permutate and slip away. The effect of this is circularity, as if it were programmed with continual replay loops, but the algorithms in fact generate initiate an interplay between the random and the non-random. And I would also say that Jackson McLowe is a kind of precursor, just as John did, as would be John Cage, I think. Sorry, as did Mark. In all, all of these figures, we can see an investment in the mechanisms by which pattern, structure, and order emerges spontaneously. In all, we can see a visual presentation of rule-based behavior. However, the programmable aspect of Cayley's text generation procedures renders them practically and theoretically different from print-based experiments. There's a limit, then, to the apperceptive links that one would establish. While the morphological and even phonic relations among the letters serve to stabilize signification to a certain extent, insofar as the reader, as you're probably able to do now, can intermittently pick up some of the patterns inherent in the transformation of the text, it's still the case that legibility is only partially ensured on the side of production. That is, the time-based sequences in translation, the ambient states of the piece, are generated by algorithms that are relatively simple, but nevertheless produce complex semiotic effects. Translation, then, is inherently unstable, enacting liminal hybrid linguistic phenomena rather than the translations or generations of language per se. These linguistic phenomena are legible as language only to the extent that the reader user understands them to be approximations of such. And maybe this is one answer to the question that was posed of Noah's Project Screen, which I think the question had to do with the stability of the narrative of decomposition. And I think, in a sense, Cayley's giving you inherent instability. Even the narrative, even the sort of decomposition is not itself stabilized, that narrative. There's also a translatability among the different media in translation, which is at once fluid textual sculpture, fragmented visual image, and sound composition. I just have the sound turned off because it's too distracting. The split screen suggests that one medium resonates off of another, but there's not a strict one-to-one correspondence between the two. The page layout simulates a kind of translation and equivalence between the two sides, as if they formally recognized and responded to each other. Recognition or equivalence, however, are not present at the linguistic level, as one might suppose with the use of the image of the page, but at the coding level, with the bell sounds and the cursor linked conditionally to the appearance of certain instantiations of language. Informed by contemporary critical discourse on cross-cultural translation, and by Cayley's own practice as a translator, these translations enact the remainder, the incompleteness of linguistic exchange, and the literal movements of language. The translations of Proust, for example, do not pass through English en route from French to German, as would be the case for any standard machine translation, informed as they would be by the technologies developed on the basis of Warren Weaver's understanding of translation as decryption. Rather, the visual representation of the pages from the German translation implies a proximity to the original French that would not necessarily be implied by a transcribed version of the text. But I want to turn primarily to the source text, so to speak, for translation, insofar as one can fix a source for a piece that calls into question the very status of a primary or originary text, and it's Benjamin's essay on language. Translation attains its full meaning in the realization that every evolved language can be considered a translation of all the others. By the relation of languages as between media of varying densities, the translatability of languages is established. Translation is removal from one language into another through a continuum of transformations. Translation passes through continua of transformation, not abstract areas of identity and similarity. In its basic operation, translation, Cayley's Project Translation, is an enacting of Benjamin's conception of translation as the generation of language. The project thematizes and performs translation as transformation. One translation, one transformation produces another. Moreover, the translation from one sign into another is also the translation of one media into another. In that the source text is itself a kind of translation of Benjamin, he's done some lineation, just as he's done with Overboard. He did versification of the William Bradford, and here he's done some lineation of Benjamin. The source text, then, is also a version that would call into question the notion of an original. So here we have to focus on what I take to be the most important of the changes that Cayley has made. With the exception of the word of God, that parenthetical notation from Cayley's transcription. So he's left out, you can see, from the Benjamin, that parenthetical notation. The word of God is for Benjamin the originary language in a mystical sense, the pure language in which word and referent coincide. By omitting the reference to the word of God, Paley eliminates, or perhaps simply appears to eliminate, the transcendental. Excluding the word of God, in other words, leaves no non-translated language. Rather, all languages are translations of other languages. But the omission of the Benjaminian transcendental also leaves open the possibility that there might be a substitute operating, as it were, beneath the surface. In other words, for a critic deeply invested in the distinction between symbolic and operational code, code itself must certainly be understood as a generative sign system, as a language that generates all others. Code, then, might even be thought as transcode in this other sense, as a language that forms rather than passes through continua of transformation. That the text describing the transformation is the very text being transformed, however, should alone indicate that Cayley would refuse the claim for a code as a transcendental sign system. Thinking code as a transcendental inevitably, and to my mind disconcertingly, lands one in the space of the computational hypothesis. The computational hypothesis holds that microphysical processes, rather than comprising the fundamental level of what we might call a material real, are instead generated by underlying computational processes. By bits governed by a computational algorithm. This meta-hypothesis explains both the singularity and the totality of computation, whether it be framed as Ed Fredkin's digital universe, which is at core some sort of universal computer, or Stephen Wolfram's new kind of science, which suggests that physical reality is comprised of cellular automata. This hypothesis, then, understands the world to be fundamentally computational, building complex behaviors and entities out of simple rules. With this hypothesis in mind, and with an acute awareness of the implementation of ubiquitous computing, Catherine Hales has adapted the Derridean aphorism, "There is no outside to text," into "There is no outside to code." And that's actually from an unpublished essay called "The Traumas of Code." Cellular automata function, but they also provide new metaphors for computer science, engineering, and new media, new models for organizing and presenting information. As Kate explains the entwining of means and metaphor, computation as a means and computation as a metaphor, into a generative cultural dynamic, she notes, in the regime of computation, code is understood as the discourse system that mirrors what happens in nature and that generates nature itself. Such a description of computation as at once metaphor and actual process calls up a different meaning for transcode, that provided by Lev, of course, for whom transcoding more broadly suggests the transfer of computer categories and concepts into the cultural realm. It is in this sense that we can understand our situatedness within the network society, then, the database society, or even the computational society. The pursuit of universal translatability, as Peter sort of notes in the program, is one of the logics of new media. This is transcodification, as media theorist Wilhelm Flusser articulates it, the translation of one message into another, the translation from a denoting code, which has a singular meaning, to a connotating code, which is open and ambiguous. Without the possibility of transcodification, we'd be left with the notion that either a singular closed message or a multivalent open message in some way reflects the natural order of the world. This is not to say, however, that transcodification is without limits, that it allows for total transmissibility, or that there's a one-to-one correlation between messages. Rather, as Flusser explains, one universe may have two or more codes to communicate messages about it, and that in some codes there may be an overlap of universes. They are partly translatable into certain codes and partly not. And the limitations of translation show that no code refers to all the universes and no universe is referred to by all the codes. So in other words, there is no metacode, no final program of a final apparatus, since, as Flusser explains it, every program requires a metaprogram by which it is programmed. The hierarchy of programs must be open at the top. The apparatus, however, in this instance code, remains a black box, ultimately unknowable. Functionaries control and are controlled by it, but its interior remains impenetrable. So this is partly behind my question to Mark this morning about the user or the viewer not perceiving the de-differentiation of code beneath, I guess, as it were, the interface. What Flisser makes apparent is that the interior, the black box, is not only impenetrable, but also not subject to modification. So invisibility itself is not the only obstruction. It's not only invisibility, but also the inability to modify. This echoes Friedrich Kittler on the secrecy system, hiding a whole machine from its users, the occlusion of assembly code, the descent from software to hardware, from the higher to lower levels of observation. In his reading of Kittler, Andrew McKenzie, who I mentioned at the outset, refers to the inaccessible interior spaces of code over which no panoptic view could be made available. He also has recourse to the rhetoric of backgrounding with rhetoric to code's invisibility, both in a technical sense and with respect to its embedding as ideology within a social fabric. And the treatment of code as a black box is quite extensive. Alan Sondheim, who's given us the term code work, talks about code work as simultaneously facile and opaque. And he notes that, you know, you'd have to be the author to follow a work of code work. But then Catherine Hales points out that, in fact, it's often the case that a program is inaccessible even to its own programmer, whether because enough time has passed or because other people have been involved and so forth. And then I think, too, one would have to point to the work that Michael Mateus and Nick Monfort have done on obfuscation in code and the obfuscated C contest in which obscurity and illegibility become aesthetic values and so forth. Code may be mysterious, cryptic, and in a sense unknowable, but it is also, as Ted Warnell's Lascaux Symbolic reminds us, made. And Lascaux came up this morning, but this is it in a different version. This is just a screen capture of the poem. What you'll see, those of you that can read JavaScript, what you'll see on the sort of final or top layer is the symbolic representation of the code that is reproducing the number, number that will vary with every reload in the bottom left corner. It's somewhat akin to the opening of Godard's Contempt, in that the laying bare of the conditions of production is really a laying bare of the symbolic conditions of production. Analogizing the cave painting to code, Warnell's visual poem reminds us that the hand, craft, skill, technical expertise, comes in between code and surfaces of inscription, here the wall of the cave. It poses the question, are all of the code processes manifest to the reader? Is its source open? And how would we know if it were? Code may be, in a general sense, opaque and legible only to specialists, much like a cave painting sign system, but it has been inscribed, programmed, written. It is conditioned and concretely historical. That is, code is a constructing force, but also that which is constructed. Finally, for Flisser, the possibility of transcodification, of converting older media forms into codes, presents writing not only with the taint of its own obsolescence, but also with two routes away from itself, back to the image, back to the traditional image, or forward to the code, back to the imagination, or forward into calculation. What his writings suggest, however, is that these two directions, back and forward, can merge surprisingly into one another. Figures can be computed to images. From textual writing and thinking, we can try to escape into imagined calculations. And it's toward this possible future for writing that I think John Cayley's work gestures. Thanks.